fisherman said, you're not right. Now I'm staying up all night.
Hey friends, it's the Crow Boys. Our debut album, Made to Wonder, is out now.
Download and stream it wherever you listen to music.
Hey friends, it's the Crow Boys. Our debut album, Made to Wonder, is out now.
Download and stream it wherever you listen to music.
Hey everyone, this is Ismay, musician, host, and creator of Finding Lucinda. In anticipation of our documentary film coming out this fall, I've put together an in-depth companion podcast. It delves into the origins and artistry of legendary singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. New episodes are out every other week on the BGS Podcast Network. So join me on this creative journey.
Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. I'm Cindy Howes. Thanks for checking out the show today. We are in the midst of our reissue series. That's right, dear listener. As I am on maternity leave for a month, we have decided to reissue some of our favorite past Basic Folk episodes. And today we are revisiting a 2021 conversation between Lizzie No and Dar Williams. Before we get to that, have you signed up for our newsletter? You can at the link in the show notes. It's a once-a-month email, lets you know who's coming on the podcast and who's been on recently, and all of our innermost thoughts and feelings. You can also follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube at Basic Folk Pod. And we're a listener-supported operation. If you feel so inclined, you can make a contribution, basicfolk.com/donate, or you can grab the link in the show notes. This was fun to listen back to not only this Dar Williams episode, but this was right around the time that Lizzie joined Basic Folk as co-host. And our intros were so long, it almost makes me want to like go back to that where we're just like chit-chatting a bit because, I mean, I don't know about you. I don't know what it's like to not be me and listen to this, but I was delighted listening to our chit-chat. And in fact, I wanted to share a little bit of that chit-chat right now. This is us discussing some random insurance commercial in which we transition into talking about our driver's ed teachers.
There's that like radio commercial of like an auto insurance company that's like having people count. You know how you're supposed to like count to two before you start driving? It, like if you're at a red light, I'm not making any sense. You're at a red light, the okay. light turns green, the car in front of you goes, you're supposed to count to two before you go.
Why is that?
For safety.
Oh.
And then there's like a guy going, one Mississippi, two Mississippi. And then he goes, I don't know if you know this, I'm a driver's ed teacher.
But you're not my driver's ed teacher. My driver's ed teacher was Boyd Jensen. Shout out to Boyd, who teaches new drivers all around the state of New Jersey. To this day, when I learned to drive at the ripe age of 26, he would come to my house every weekend and pick me up. And then we would drive around and talk and parallel park. And he's a very sweet man. So love you, Boyd.
Was he nice?
Super
nice.
My
driver's ed teacher was so mean, but Aww. It was effective because I still remember things that he would say, like when you're merging, you have to check your blind spot. And then he like basically like punched the side of the, like he's in the passenger seat and he punches the side of the car. He's like, or else, bam.
Oh my God.
And like I never, there's a couple things that I've never forgotten. I don't remember his name. I'm sure my high school friends, my five high school friends that listen to this are like, it was blah, blah, blah.
Since that episode posted, I have discovered that my driver's ed teacher's name was Bill Rehill. Okay, on to Dar Williams. In fact, I thought Lizzie did an excellent job introducing Dar Williams back in 2021. I'm going to air the original intro. So we'll listen to this original intro. And then Dar actually starts the interview off performing the title track from her latest album. Here we are setting up that 2021 Dar Williams interview on Basic Folk.
Today's a big day for Basic Folk. A lot of dreams came true with this Dar Williams interview. And why don't you set us up? I'm so excited for everyone.
Okay, Cindy, this interview was a dream come true, not only because I have been such a big fan of Dar Williams since I got her CD at the Princeton Record Exchange in like 2004.
Which one?
I think it was The Green World.
Okay, yeah.
That's where I started. And also because she's just one of the most like giving, engaging people that I've gotten to talk with about music. It's just really, really cool to hear from her. So Dar Williams is a singer-songwriter legend at this point. She is from Mount Kisco, New York, and she grew up in what she describes as a time and a household where people were being encouraged to break down the old ways and learn new ways of expressing themselves. So for her, that meant learning about theater and learning about music and playing instruments. She ended up going to Wesleyan University and studying theater and religion. And her engagement with matters of the heart and spirit is something that still shines through in her music. She's, I think, one of the most interesting songwriters right now, talking about religion and talking about spirituality in such a humane and like nuanced and respectful way.
Can I just make can I just make one comment about Dar? So like traditionally I've not been like a lyrics person. Usually the first thing that catches me, especially in like an artist like Dar, who has a lot of like really wonderful hooky melodic music on her songs, the way that she combines that skill of like making something that's incredibly catchy and also making something that is like fucking devastating is insane. You know, it's like it just kind of like sneaks up on you and you're like, oh, holy shit, this song is actually about, you know, XYZ.
But anyways, her, the like a lot of great artists, like for her, the melody is the way in. And so, OK, so after college, she moves to Boston, gets into the scene there. And we talked a lot about like what a healthy art scene looks and feels like when you're in it. She wrote and released, you know, her amazing album, The Honesty Room, and kind of like went to the folk big time. She was a part of the original Lilith Fair tour, and we talked a lot about that. I mean, what a legend. The lineup, I can't even actually talk about all of the heroes that she was singing with there. They were part of a movement of feminist art that wanted to show that like all female lineups could be commercially successful and that it mattered to do that. Yeah.
Did men hate it? Did the bad men hated it? The good men
boy, oh boy, oh boy, did people hate it. But only a few haters, you know, like it was like one of the most financially successful tours ever. They sold out everything. So we got to talk a lot.
I could just go on and on about the Lilith Fair and, you know, people calling it lame. And like, what is so lame about a music festival that fucking sells out every show?
Yeah, that's called rock and roll. That's what that is. So we talked about Lilith Fair. We talked about, you know, I was curious to kind of sit at the feet of a master and pick her brain. As a feminist musician myself, I am curious to know, like, what's different? What does someone who, like, really has been through it have to say about feminism now and women in music now? And what would it take for another Lilith Fair to happen? What would it take for another like great uprising of women in the music industry. So Dar had some great insights about that. And her most recent album that's coming out October 1st, oh, it'll be out by the time this episode airs, is called I'll Meet You Here. And it's a great album. Dar was kind enough to play a song live for me from the album. It deals a lot with a person coming to terms with the passage of time, acceptance, place, small towns, some of Dar's like bread and butter.
It has everything.
It really does have everything. It's so great. So yeah, it was really cool to talk to her about like the making of that album, which to me feels like, oh, this would be a masterpiece someone wrote in quarantine. But interestingly enough, it was mostly recorded before the pandemic, and then hit some definite speed bumps on the way to release because people on her team came down with COVID. It was just like this wild ride. And I'm so glad that the album is finally going to be out in the world.
That's great. Well, thanks, Lizzie, for setting us up. And Dar actually started the interview off with the title track. She just played the whole thing. And I think that's how we'll start our interview.
Thanks, Cindy.
Ready for this?
I don't think anyone's ready for Dar Williams.
Listen, we're just diving right into it. Okay, let's listen to this song. It is the title track from Dar's new album, I'll Meet You Here, and then we'll get to our conversation with Lizzie Ngo and Dar Williams on Basic Folk.
Time, be my friend, be my friend. Though I have not been so kind to you, always asked where you were going, though you had no way of knowing, no time, I have not been kind to you. Time, meet me here, I meet you here. And we'll go walking for a little while. And I know what I will say. I know there's only now and yesterday. Oh, time, I meet you here. 'Cause when I thought that I was alone, you snapped your fingers and a tree came into bloom. And the sun came by to fill my room. Oh, time. Tell me something that has not happened yet. You will never make a promise, but I can get just what I get. And you will never say you love me. You will never say you love me, but I can love just what I get. Time, I'll make it up to you. We'll go walking down that wide country road, and I will be a brave companion, your adventurous D'Artagnan. I will be your best receiver, your goldenest retriever. I'll remember what you taught me and those treasures that you brought me. Most of all, a lifetime of friends together when I asked you to be one of them. Oh, time, be my friend. 'Cause when I thought that I was alone, you snapped your fingers and a tree came into bloom. And the sun came by to fill my room. Oh, time. Tell me something that has not happened yet. You will never make a promise, but I can get just what I get. And you will never say you love me. You will never say you love me. You will never say you love me. But let's can't see what's round the bend.
Thank you so much. Never in my wildest dreams did I think I would have a one-on-one living room performance from Dar Williams. And that is a track off of your new record, I'll Meet You Here, which comes out in October. And I have a million questions about that record. But as we get to talking, I'd love to start kind of from the beginning, if that's cool with you. I've read that you started playing the guitar at age 9 and your parents were super encouraging. I just want you to set the scene for us of like how young Dar became a songwriter. Was there music in the house? Were you exposed to a lot of culture and art, or did you seek that out on your own?
Well, you know, I think it was the time that it was the '70s, you know, and the '70s, you had the '60s where a lot of stuff broke open. And then the '70s was kind of like, everything's broken open. Let's see how it rolls. And so,
right.
You know, when you were 9 years old, you played an instrument. And my parents had folk music on all the time on the record player.
Who were some of your favorites then?
You know, my dad had an alphabetized record collection. And it was like everything from B, C, and D was so it's the Birds, you know, so
oh,
all
yes,
that
yes,
harmony,
yes.
The harmony of singing of the, so, and Joan Baez and Judy Collins and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Jim Croce. And a little bit of Bob Dylan, but, you know, we were three girls and we liked our girls, you know, we liked Judy and Joan. So, and then you would kind of go down to the Mamas and the Papas and Simon and Garfunkel. So it was all of that really harmonic, Harry Belafonte. So that was a B.
Yeah.
So all of that harmonic stuff from the folk, folk rock was really in the rotation. And then my dad had a whole classical thing. And so he would listen to classical music that would come blaring through the house. Anytime he worked in his workshop in the basement, I don't know what he was, you know, whatever he was fixing, he would blare opera and sing along. So we had, and there was a station called QXR. So there was all this classical that my dad liked. And then we had folk, and there was this blur between the two. And we were encouraged to not see classical music or folk music as that different from each other. You know, like that they were both really important contributions to humanity. And I think, and my parents really respected that. And they used to bring us to see local productions of plays at
great.
Our, you know, the downtown with the Chappaqua Drama Group. And that was the real, like, okay, this is a really big deal. You're about to see a musical. And they didn't say things like, with people you're going to see in the grocery store. Like, they just elevated it.
You saw everything from, you know, local theater to Mozart as like all on the same continuum of the history of art.
Exactly. And I think that was a 70s thing. And that was my parents. And, you know, my father was he was really interested in he did audiovisual educational things. So like you'd see a slideshow. And he worked for the, you know, he wrote the text for the slideshow that you'd watch in your classroom. But he was really interested, like the whole company was really interested, kind of lifting the bar. So they would put in like rock music as examples of stuff. And he did one thing about the Bible once and used, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash and, you know, like singing Woodstock, Joni Mitchell's Woodstock with like a painting by Rousseau, you know, and of the.
I bet that was kind of a shakeup.
Yeah, it was. Well, it was no. The 70s were all about kind of getting everything off of its pedestal and giving everything a little bit more equality and its own breathing space, you know. And that was so then I started. And the thing is also that means there's high participation. So there was a summer stock theater that I got to be a part of. And there were guitar lessons that people were giving. And, you know, it was a time when I was like, yeah, I play an instrument. You play an instrument. You want to write songs. Great. You know, even though there was such a thing as celebrity, you know, and that was important.
It was still for the people in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, and it was kind of expected, I think, from in general, but certainly my parents.
And the thing is, like, there's definite like scene setting and drama in your music. And I know you studied theater in college. When did it start to become clear that like music was going to be the path And that, you know, because it seems like you were kind of equally interested in like theater and other forms of art and music. Like, when did you realize, like, I'm a songwriter?
It was decided for me because I was in Boston, and a friend of mine said, you know, I had all these friends in New York, and it just seemed like they were spending so much time just paying the rent and getting around. And my friend said, just move to Boston. It's so affordable. You can get a cappuccino and a bagel for less than $2. And I was like, okay. And I didn't realize that, you know, places really specialize in what they do. And what I tell people now, if they're interested in music, is to go where the scene is. And there are some great scenes that, like, Minneapolis has the Twin Cities have a great scene. Yes. And Boston still has that thing going on in like Cambridge. So, you know, go to the place where you can go to an open mic 4 or 5, 6 times a week. That was what was going on in Boston. What wasn't going on in Boston was a lot of homegrown regional theater. They had great theater, but most of it was like Equity cast out of New York. So,
so it just made sense. Yeah. Like you go where the work is.
Yeah. Well, I wrote a play, and I was working for the Opera Company of Boston because I thought I might want to be an opera director. But that is, there's not a lot of those positions available, and it's really best if you speak 3 languages or 4 and
can
speak, you know, music that way. You can't just direct it like a play. And, but I realized that I missed singing. And so that was a fortuitous thing. So I went to open mics and, slowly but surely kind of found my feet. It was almost like a grad school. And then, and then you could go from tip jar gigs, you know, you could have a tip open mics to tip jar gigs to opening for people to split bills with your friends. And, you know, maybe nobody was listening, but that's okay. It wasn't much worth listening to.
I mean, that's called like a paid practice.
Right. I know. Yeah. And I was on a radio show and I was like, not good. And I looked at the person afterwards and it was a college kid. And I said, I'm not so good at this yet. And they said, yeah, neither am I. Our mics weren't on. So it was like, it was perfect practice because nobody heard that.
Oh my gosh. That's a mercy.
Yeah. So we were able to learn from each other and there were song circles and things like that and grow. And then I felt like I was getting a little too, paying too much attention to sort of the rungs of the ladder, like who gets this gig, what's wrong with me? So I said, okay, I've got to move out to the country, and just write my songs. And I did. And I moved to Northampton and it was, cows and college students. And I wrote my first record, The Honesty Room. I had these 2 cassettes out, but I did my first album, my first CD called The Honesty Room at sort of just all sitting on this one futon, very heartbroken, very alone in Northampton, and with no sense of who would listen, which I guess is a really great, I was like, well, I'll follow my truth. And then I brought those things into the world and they hit some collective unconscious thing that no one could have, like, I wrote a song called When I Was a Boy, which you could argue is just a feminist song, but it was kind of weird because I wasn't feeling it as a feminist song. I was feeling it as like, I didn't know what to call it. And now we would call it gender. It was all about
something deeply personal. It's about identity.
Yeah.
You're not thinking of it as political until a bunch of other people say, I feel that way too.
Right. It's gender identity, which is more personal. I mean, it is also political, but, So I, here I am saying, when I was a boy, this happened when I was a boy, and not saying, when I was a girl who was like a boy or, it's not a feminist manifesto. And it was weird how many men came to me. And there was something, it was very co-ed, a lot of people responded to that song and it wasn't, it just hit an interesting nerve at an interesting time because acoustic music was so big in the 90s with Ani DiFranco. And I was very much on her coattails. So I was just lucky all around. But that first album it did more than splash. It was more than a little splash, which had a lot to do with its time and my luck.
Yeah, I want to talk about that time because hugely influential, doesn't even begin to cover it when it comes to so many feminist songwriters now. You were on one of the original Lilith Fair tours, which is just such a legendary landmark in music history and feminist history. Were you aware at that time that you were a part of something, like a part of something that was going to last? Or was it kind of like, these are like-minded people, we're doing what we can, and then later it hit you? Like, did you feel like, ooh, things are shifting right now?
Well, it was representative of a shift because the what had happened was, you know, and really, I think retrospect was the best way to see this. Although I think I knew at the time, there's something that, you know, radical means root. And so a lot of stuff had happened at the roots of things like kind of decentralizing music venues and the coffee house scene and people with their individual voices kind of diversely showing up. And you saw it at the end of the 80s with the Indigo Girls. They were very different from Suzanne Vega, who was very sort of downtown New York, who was very different from Tracy Chapman, who was very different.
Sarah McLachlan and Sheryl Crow. Like there was this whole.
And REM also, you know, like people like that. So, so not kind of people being able to feel their oats a little bit before they got the record contract and really getting to explore what we call the audience-based career. So that was happening. There was another thing that I only understood its power later on when I was teaching about it, which was what we call the women's music scene from the 70s. But it was really the lesbian music scene because it was, you know, you had lesbian women and gay men saying, you know, we can be together, you know, we can agitate together for everything that we want. But our movement's going to feel a little different than yours. And then you had the feminists saying, you know, a lot of this has to do with being pro-choice, you know, reproductive choice and about pay equity. And, you know, now you're asking us to bring on this whole sexual identity thing. And there was a lot more coolness there than people gave it credit for, I think. But there were also women who were like, I want to really dig in with all the stuff that I'm learning about, you know, identity, race, feminism, sexuality, experientially who I am, that can't be accomplished in a bar, in a gay bar, or in these like large caucus, you know, mostly white feminist events. So music venues became the place where you would hang out. Like there would be a bookstore with a concert series, or there would be these music festivals that would have, you know, breakout spaces for just talking about stuff. So music became the place where you was this cauldron of identity conversations and politics. And it was also a safe space for all of that. And that's really the venue through which feminism grew, because a lot of, you know, I mean, I really believe that the lesbians who came out and said, yeah, tell you go ahead and tell me that I'm building my own house and no man will ever marry me. That doesn't really affect me. That doesn't really matter to me. You know, a lot of them are like, I don't really need to participate in this whole like, which, you know, what shoes should I wear to impress a man?
Where's your husband?
Where's your husband? Exactly. So they took that power into the world in a way that I think really empowered straight women as well. So anyway, when I was starting to play, a lot of the people who were used to going to music venues as a place to kind of find safe space, conversation space, to kind of expand their world, were still there in the habit of doing that. So these blocks of women who, you know, didn't like to watch television because they couldn't see themselves in it and didn't want to go watch Rambo would come to these concerts in the early 90s. And there was just a whole lot of women coming out of that, even straight women. But, you know, there was definitely Farron and, you know, people who showed up, you know, Natalie Merchant. So, so she's, and, you know, she's straight, but there's that kind of, that empowered female voice and her narrative and her gaze that was showing up coming out of the 70s, coming out of the 80s. And then you had a lot of women who had a paycheck, you know, and they would say to their partners, girlfriend or boyfriend, like, I would like to choose what we're going to go see. And I'd like to go see Ani DiFranco. I don't want to go see Lethal Weapon 2. And so you had like some economic base that was building, and a lot of guys were like digging it and saying, okay, like, you know, they were with the program. It wasn't this, you know, and so, Lilith Fair, I call the blossom. So that's what I recognize. So you had all of this stuff going on at the roots, all of this fertilization, cross-pollination, whatever the metaphor, out of which came so much strength of all of these different women that the, you know, Sarah and the people around her were very savvy about saying, if we collected this all together and presented it in its diversity, like Michelle Netticello, Joan Osborne.
Amy Mann, like there's just the whole spectrum.
Right. If we put this all together, it's a thing, and it will be economically viable with Aveda and Volkswagen as its sponsors.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know they were the sponsors. I was going through some news articles from that tour, and like, you know, obviously some like local journalists were extremely skeptical, and there were just like such backwards ways of describing an all, you know, woman tour. But then, you know, some had to begrudgingly admit like it's the only tour of the year that's been sold out every show.
Yeah, there was a lot of, they kept on putting me close, like at the press conferences, they kept on putting me closer and closer to Sarah.
Yeah.
Because I would push back. Like I saw this coming in terms of being involved with all of the women's music stuff, like the Michigan Women's Music Festival and other sort of lesbian festivals where I was invited, even though I'm straight, you know, and the coffee house scene being so much a part of that, all of those voices. Like I was like, no, you know what? The audience who listens to this, they go home. So you might not be hearing much radical stuff in our music, but generally it's the food for the souls of people who do a lot of important work with inclusion, health, you know, pushing policies forward that are more sensitive, you know, stuff that we see today in terms of, you know, race, gender, class.
Right. Like there has to be dancing in the revolution, you know, someone's job needs to be to like feed back those soul points to the people that are giving so much on the front lines.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's what, and Lilith was this moment of celebration that it was actually such a big raft of people that it was economically viable. And,
do you think anything like that could ever happen again? Or do you think like the music business has just changed too much?
I don't think the music business is there enough to be part of the shaping process. And so it wouldn't, it's really interesting how, you know, like there was something called Down from the Mountain in the early aughts, right? So 2002, 2003. And the, and really there's a lot that's still there that's like that. Instead of it being like, okay, here's Suzanne Vega. Oh, now we have the Indigo Girls. Now we have Michelle Netticello. Now we have, you know, it's kind of like one at a time. But it's a kind of a, oh, here's a really different voice from the other woman that we were pushing forward. You know, there was a kind of a Tracy Chapman time and there was a kind of an Indigo Girls time and a Michelle Netticello time in, and that's because there would be this kind of amplifying machine from the record companies, and Lilith Fair was also heavily amplified by this industry that was heavily capitalized by the sales of these little plastic things called DVDs.
Yeah.
And they say now that the streaming is the same, but it's not, it caught everybody off guard and it didn't filter into like those kind of large events. It was more like record companies said, okay, we're going to capitalize on the fact that you're going to get your song in a car commercial as opposed to like helping to put together the way Network did Lilith Fair. So they just don't have that platform. They don't operate that way as from what I've seen as much. So
it might have to be done in more of a guerrilla way.
But organically, you know, there's so much good stuff that people do. There's just, I mean, so much farther along than it was 20, 25 years ago in terms of the transgender conversations, gender conversation. Black Lives Matter has shown us so much about what we have to work on, that it's not just micro, like they're super macro, and it's, you wake up and think about it. So you know, it's shown us the problems more than the solutions, but I think that we will now be entering into more solutional conversations. So that's all different. The environment we're even though the environment's pushing back on us right now, our approach to the environment is much more proactive than it was 25 years ago. So
it feels like we actually have like some stake in it now, It's sort of used to be this like niche liberal issue, like the green movement or whatever. But like, I think people are starting to realize, like with the hurricanes, with the floods, like this is real and it's happening to all of us.
Yeah. And I think that we're really prepared, you know, so it's just a question of how we're going to go on that. But, you know, marriage equality, legalizing pot, like decriminalizing pot, all of those things, talking about mass incarceration.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, we are much, I went to a college where that was all over the place in our conversations, but you know, there we were sort of off to the side.
Very like New England lefty, and now it's becoming more mainstream. Yeah.
Yeah. There was at my college, there was a, they drew outlines of women. This group of women drew outlines of women lying down on the ground, like a murder, you know, like a murder scene thing. And then they would say, a woman was assaulted here. And, you know, they found this map of people who had, and that, you know, that was like very Me Too before its time. And,
It's like, if you'd had the internet, if you had had the internet at the same level of saturation at that time, it could have been very different.
Exactly. But those were, you know, I was very used to people having those conversations. I remember the admissions department being like, you know, it's really hard to give college tours over those outlines of bodies. And the women were like, well, you can go to hell, you know, then you should deal with this better.
We are bringing the type of student who's going to want to know about that. Exactly. I wonder what was it like? Because you've taught it's Wesleyan College.
University.
You've taught there now. Like, do you feel like a lot of those political conversations have come a long way? Are there like through lines that you see with the students that kind of connects back to what your experience when you were there?
It was fantastic. Well, you know, I think when we were there, there was this, you know, there was a lot of self-segregation in terms of just race, just like black and white, you know, and in terms of like having these conversations, the conversations were happening, but they were within sort of these monolithic, somewhat balkanized things, you know. Balkanized means sort of mutually hostile, not meaning to be, but and there was a group of people of color from of Asian descent, and they were coming forward and saying, look, there's a whole set of conversations to have here. But it was kind of like people were in their camps explaining to other people, you know, what was going on. And we were all kind of trying to speak from. And when I went back to Wesleyan, you know, Martin Luther King says this thing about the content of, you know, people relating to each other by the content of their hearts. And I mean, it makes me a little emotional, but it was like these kids were side by side, like music nerds who were listening, like one with an ear pod in, you know, and the other with an ear pod in there, like sharing ear pods, listening to the same music, going like, you know, and it was racially all diverse. It was all like what Martin Luther King had said, you know, that I said, and I kept on seeing these clicks of people based on, you know, sports or music or English or flowy skirts or whatever. But it was not based on skin color. It was like, when I was there, we didn't want to be, you know, that balkanized, but we were of the time, and we weren't finding each other as well. And now I saw, you know, meditation groups that were, you know, everything was mixed. And that's kind of aspirational, a vision of what the world could look like. But I felt like Wesleyan, for all of its agitation, had really, you know, kept on working at it and had these environments. And that's what I'm seeing on college campuses now in general. I mean, it's not, again, it's like you have to look at the systemic and the institutional. And at the same time, we can celebrate some ways that people are able to really connect on the content of their hearts. And the way
music
they
nerds
that.
Are going to find each other, you know, one way or another. That's a good, really good thing. I want to talk about the new record. I'll Meet You Here. It feels like it's a gorgeous record. I've had it on repeat. It feels like this sort of sunlit window into your life. And I know that the process of making it was hugely affected by COVID. I think it would have been different if you'd made it, I don't know, in 2018 or 2019.
All right. Here's the thing. We recorded it in 2019.
Oh my gosh.
It's a pre-COVID record. And we did too, but it was affected by COVID because there was one track that wasn't coming out. So I went to my friend Leary to do the song Time Be My Friend. And we were supposed to mix it, and things were getting kind of funky because it was in March 2020. Mm-hmm. And Leary actually said, I said, I'm not sure if I can make it. And my manager was saying, if you guys do work together, I want you to make sure you have a hand sanitizer. Like, we didn't know about the masks. And yeah. Leary,
remember when they were telling us not to wear masks?
Right, right. And that, so and so then Leary said, actually, I it's good if we delay it a little bit because I don't feel so good. Leary had COVID, and Leary had a bad case of COVID. So if he had come down,
you would have all been,
everything could have been different. I mean, it was a building filled with producers and musicians, and a lot of them were, you know, had lung issues, I think, because a lot of them were like older and had smoked a lot of pot and cigarettes. And so, you know, it was a kind of a groovy, aging group of musicians and artists in New Jersey. And I, you know, so it, we were touched by that. And then we did have to do a lot of mixing and remixing via, you know, like calls and stuff to get it right. So, you know, it was sort of refining our language to make sure we were on the same page. But it was a wonderful, it's bizarrely filled with references to the pandemic, for the fact that it came out before the pandemic.
There is some witchy power that you have to have as a songwriter if you're going to speak to people, really.
I mean, this makes me believe in the witchy thing, because there's just, I don't know, there's references. I mean, especially like time, I'll meet you here, I'll meet you here. Like, okay, time, you have the reins. That was very much the anthem for me of the pandemic.
Is that sort of like a, do you lean into Buddhism or Eastern philosophy at all? Like, I know you are very well studied in religion, but does it go beyond a study into a personal practice, or is it just something that you think about kind of cerebrally?
I returned to what I call OTC Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Late in September last year. So I'm coming up on a year where, instead of meditating for 10 minutes a day, I meditated for an hour, 10 or 15 minutes of which is listening to Pema Chodron or Thich Nhat Hanh, but mostly Pema Chodron.
I love her.
It has been really, it's changed everything. It changed everything. And especially coming back out into touring, I'm seeing, you know, like when I was on mountain stage the other day and I didn't really know what to do with myself, I just said, well, this is the fundamental ambiguity of life.
Right.
This isn't, I'm not supposed to know what to do with myself. And, or if I have a bad gig, it's like, was that a bad gig? Was that a good gig? Yeah. I don't know. Like, life is really ambiguous, and who's to say? So don't get hung up.
You have no idea. Sometimes, like, I'll find like what I think is the worst gig ever. Someone will email me later, like, oh, I hadn't even heard of you, and I caught the show and it made my night. For you, that was like a horrible experience. And then for everyone else, it was completely different. You can just,
I know.
Sometimes you have no idea.
And yet I didn't have a basket into which to hold all that stuff. And I feel like the sort of return to Buddhism is being able to say, oh, I don't know if that was good. I don't know if that was bad. It just was. It's just what happened, you know? And I don't have to go, you know, I don't have to like have a glass of wine and just chill out and go, you know, and break from that. I just have to deal with the fact that life, you know, most of the environment around us is air. You know, sometimes life just feels like air. It doesn't feel like you're doing something right or wrong. It's just air. And that's kind of just reality. And it really helped to I don't know, it's like pretty central to my life at this point. It's just made me a little friendlier.
I can imagine. I mean, it's all over this album.
But again, it wasn't there. I mean, the practice came after the album. But yes, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Sometimes you're processing something in your mind, maybe, and then you figure out what to do with it later. I was so touched by the re-recording of You're Aging Well. It's like such a powerful song. Loved the original. What did it feel like to sing that again after maybe 25 years? Can you talk a little bit about re-singing it, revisiting those moments?
This version, you know, redoing it was about Joan for me, because I was the same age that she was when she took me out. And it was, it's funny because I wrote the song and then she chose to sing it with me after I'd recorded it and put it out in the world. And yet she is emblematic of that song and of mm-hmm. the person who comes along, the woman of voices who that comes voice. Along and says, I'm glad that you're here with the things you know now that only time can tell. Like that was always, that was so Joan, which mm-hmm. is, you know, again, I wrote the song and then Joan was so sisterly. Like she brought me to the front of the tour bus the first day I was traveling with them and everybody else was in the back like, oh, she's having that talk with the opening act so mm-hmm. that the opening act won't be intimidated and so that she'll feel like she's a part of this team. And they all hung out in the back while Joan sort of told me her life stories and some of her struggles and some of the things that she's dealt with in this way to connect me to her as a person. And to say, you know, like she was, it was kind of like I had done a lot of therapy and now here I was going out on the road and she had been on the road forever before she went to therapy. And it was kind of a, oh, so we all do everything, but in a different order. Like she did everything she could to equalize mm-hmm. the situation so that she could empower me as a fellow musician as much as possible.
Wow.
It was fantastic. She really didn't have to do that. And, but that was who she was.
Ooh, that's powerful. Cause the way that I heard the song, like the new version, it sort of feels like you speaking to a past self, even like that's the way that I heard it. And then I read what you said about Joan Baez and I was like, oh, of course, like these are the conversations we're having with our, I don't know.
And the sisterhood I experienced, you know, there's nothing mm-hmm. like getting it out of the magazine article, you know, about like when people were talking in the pandemic about how they're using their times, like they're like, I really want to unplug and learn more about myself and, you know, not, you know, be so caught up in the rat race. Cause I read this magazine article that said that. Then the pandemic happens. It's like, yeah, you're really going to learn about that. Like this isn't just some nice, you know, quasi spiritual article about, you know, unplugging. This is like, you're really going to gain some weight here and you're really going to have to.
This is 6 months of sweatpants.
Yeah. And you're really going to have to get into like the deeply okayness of that. Mm-hmm. And it was very, it was so nice to get away from the rhetoric of like someday. Yeah. I know I should meditate. It's like, well, why don't you just try meditating and maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't, you know,
maybe one day I'll slow down.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I'm doing this one little ritual of chewing my food 20 times so I can really understand what it's like to slow down. It's like, how about something like you're locked in your house for months at a time and you can't go to your job? How about let's try that as a ritual for, you know, really having your own. I think people really like experientially got into like what works for me. I mean, mm-hmm. I sleep from two to nine. That's like I go to bed at two. I just don't. I'm not pretending anymore.
What are you up to in those hours? Are you like a late night mystery TV watcher? Are you writing?
There's plenty of that. No, it's not a good time for writing biorhythmically. So I probably ideally I would be going to sleep at like, you know, doing a 1 to 8 kind of thing and then like mm-hmm. getting up. That's a good time. But no, I get back to people, you know, it's somehow, I don't know. Yeah. I just do. But I also kind of do nothing, as it were. I do a lot of kitchen cleaning at around like 1:30. You should do yoga at 1 a.m, which is great. You just take off your clothes. Like you don't get into special clothes.
Oh
you just
gosh.
Take stuff off. And there you are. Living room, I'm like, why does anybody do like in-person yoga? Sorry.
Yeah.
I know a lot of yoga
instructors. No, I mean like speaking of what works for you, like I have completely left bras behind in 2019. Like it just doesn't serve me anymore.
It doesn't have to. Yeah. And so the question now is, what are we going to bring back into like, I think a lot of people, you know, somebody just drove me crazy. He said that he flies for work all the time. And I said, but didn't you learn? And it's not like Doctors Without Borders,
right?
You know, it's like a job. And I said, but why, what didn't you learn that you could like Zoom stuff instead of having to fly, which is so bad for the environment. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, I have to prove that it's better for the bottom line. And I just thought, but the planet has a bottom line. And yet the bottom line has its own force and it has its own sort of weird faceless reality. And so now we have to come back and say, you know, I was a better worker when I was able to walk my own mm-hmm. dog in the middle of the day. And when I was able to, you know, my kids really don't want me to say anything to them, but they like me to be around. It's called the potted mm-hmm. plant theory. And so I like to be in my home office and I like to walk the dog so I don't have to hire somebody. And I also like to make my own lunch so I'm not wasting. And, you know, so the question is, are we going to have that? Is that faceless bottom line reality going to come back to us and go, I get it. That's mm-hmm. how we're going to proceed. Or is it just going to say, sorry, I'm not seeing how this fits on the ledger. So we have to just do everything that we did the same way again. And does that make good work?
Like,
because I think it makes worse work, you know, except that I look more obedient because I'm like struggling to find, you know, childcare, you know, because my kid gets sick and I can't find a babysitter. So you get to watch me sweat, you know, for you. But I'm not sure if that's mm-hmm. better work. So just the whole question, you know, how we're going to come back out into this with our bras, you know, are we going to shave as much? I don't know, you know. And it will be a little bit of personal courage to decide how we're going to stand in that mm-hmm. now that we're outside. And I'm seeing some of that happen too. It's you know, an opportunity.
Oh, that's a good point. Nowadays, I feel like I'm spending a little more time defending my daily naps. Because like in the pandemic, napping, mm-hmm. of course, what else would you do? Yeah. But like now that touring is back and people are actually busy, it's like, no, I actually realize that I need this every single day.
And you know what? That's just like a secret of our success as musicians that we can do that. Like that we can be cats that just go like, I do it all the time. I curl up and fall asleep all the time. I mean, people just expect that of me and I don't.
Yes.
That's like lucky me that I can do that. And then there's all the articles.
Yeah. I don't work at a bank.
Yeah.
Leave me alone. I want to get into, I just have so many questions and I want to be respectful of your time. I want to talk about places on this new album. I'm thinking in particular about Little Town and Berkeley. And you're someone that has traveled a ton, who's studied cities, written about towns, written about the places that we share and the issues that come up when we're all in one place, right? Like, how do we welcome a newcomer? How do we welcome someone that doesn't look like us? How do we share resources? Places in this country that are like getting it right. That are like,
well,
yeah, places that are like coming up with solutions that we should be learning from.
It's, you know, I wrote this whole book it's called What I Found in 1,000 Towns. So I had a bunch to choose from. And there was this thing that I identified that's called positive proximity.
Yes.
And any place that has positive proximity is, first of all, I call it the Byron town, buy your real estate now. So, I mean, but ideally then they, you know, care enough that they can also care about their lower income neighbors.
Yes.
But, and they try. It's hard once you've improved your town because everybody wants your real estate and everybody wants to be there. So places with high positive proximity, it's like, how did they get there? So the my big go-to example is Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, a shadow economy, drugs, prostitution, people, you know, locked their doors and drove through fast, that kind of thing, bad lighting, and a lot of kind of about the the steel belt becoming the rust belt. So and the coal belt going down too. So history, you know, so there are these ways that people come to finding each other. And it's not like they sit around and go, hey, let's all get along. Let's all just be cool. Let's just try to win each other over to this amorphous idea of kindness. They found their history. There's all these layers of history that they brought in. So that's, you know, there's other things like food, your regional beauty, your arts, your whatever you want to capitalize on. They capitalized on their history. Just like a person is like, I like my nose. I don't like my ears, you know, so I'll get this haircut and I'll do, you know, pierce my nose. So they're the best example. It's really cool. There's like the whole watershed that they've, you know, they show you the history of the watershed. They have one of the old steel mill buildings with some of the machinery inside and they use it as an event space and like wedding couples stand in front of this big shafty thing. Yeah. And so there's that, but they have this thing called Blobfest. And Blobfest is a celebration of the fact that the Blob was filmed in Phoenixville.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, yeah, it's a sci-fi weekend. And it's fantastic. It's funny. They have a celebration on Friday night where they reenact the running out of the Colonial Theater because the Blob is chasing them. So 9:30 at night, they run screaming and everybody films it. And so out of that, and all the planning of that, there's this other thing that they do that's called the Firebird Festival. Mm-hmm. And I saw some postcards. It's like, it's that time again. Mm-hmm. And everybody comes and works and builds this giant phoenix out of wood pallets. And anybody can join. And so you have these different kinds of backgrounds of right. like, you know, people who are used to doing this and people who aren't used to doing it. And so there's so much side-by-side stuff. So Blobfest led to Firebird Festival. And Firebird Festival is also like restaurant, mm-hmm. you know, it's good for the restaurants. Then now they have restaurant week. And so it's like this one thing leads to another. They also have a very accessible waterfront. They also have a really happening downtown now. Mm-hmm. They also have a senior center that's really active. And there's just ways that they are able to look out for each other as humans of varying, you know, mental abilities, backgrounds, trauma, and incomes. And it's been, there's a history of multiracial working side by side stuff that is, you know, Pennsylvania is an interesting state, but you know, you see some of that side by side stuff mm-hmm. happening in the town as well. So it's, I would say any town that I found that has high positive proximity, like Phoenixville, where they let their own history, their own like Tai Chi, their own balance of what makes them unique and special, lead them into right. resiliency and pride and uniqueness, you know, and a way to bring in some money from the outside world mm-hmm. will be a place. Iowa City, Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, Carrboro, all of the places around the triangle cities of North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina. They're places that are kind of known to be very sort of liberal and stuff. And people mm-hmm. have said that they actually are strangely, they can feel strangely backward. Like mm-hmm. they can feel a little rigid in their thing. So, and I won't say what they are, but somebody's like, I know a Black woman who's like, I can't even. And, you know, like, this is like, they don't get how bad it is. But the places with that energy of, let's really learn from each other. Mm-hmm. Detroit has it right now. There's yeah. a lot of industrious energy there. Berkeley, you know, as a city of dreamers, is still a city of dreamers. It's wealthier dreamers, yes. but there's still like a lot of not as wealthy dreamers. Mm-hmm. There's places to live. And that vision of what the world can be and that insistence that we hold on to that vision, no matter where we are, is still very much in Berkeley. Mm. So, but I would say I've seen it all over. I've seen it in Alaska and all sorts of cities in Alaska. And
oh my gosh, that just triggered. I had a dream about Alaska last night that I watched a line of people, one after another, get into a hot air balloon and float off to Alaska. Sorry to interrupt that very meaningful talk on cities, but that memory just was triggered.
If I knew you better, we would dig in. I love dream analysis. I'm terrible at it, but I love doing it.
I love to talk about dreams and I don't know anything.
I think it's just, as my friend Bryn says, strong and wrong.
Strong and wrong.
I like to go in strong and wrong with dream interpretation. But so I think the places, it's not really about politics. It's about where people have dug in to who they are, where they are, and feeling proud of that and finding things to be proud of and building on it and having partnerships that are interesting between schools and towns and things like that. Anything that has almost like, you look at the energy between things and say, ooh, look at all that mojo juju stuff going on between mm-hmm. these people, this willingness to look at this next thing. Like, let's have fire, you know, we have waterfall. Let's have waterfall festival day. Right. Yeah, let's try, you know, any place where people have started.
And various groups coming together to make it
right,
happen.
Groups and individuals. And also, like, mm-hmm. not precious, like saying, yeah, so-and-so is really annoying. He's just really good at sound, yeah. but don't talk to him because he's so annoying. But, you know, he's mean. But this person makes brownies and she's you know, and she's lovely and she's super shy. But this yeah. person has no skill set whatsoever except that they introduce concerts. So let's just mm-hmm. love their extroverted personality. Like that, any place that where people have kind of found each other there with a sense of humor and capitalizing on a way mm-hmm. to be like this through their projects. As opposed to like, you know, if you use our bathrooms, right. we'll shoot you in the head, you know, those kinds of environments are really wonderful. And it's not related to any state or politics.
Over. Yeah. I have one more question about the album and then if you're willing, I would like to do a lightning round. I want to talk on about the excellent vocal performances on this record. So emotive, so clear. Yeah. And I wonder how you develop, like, how you're going to perform on a recording. Do you like to share things with friends? Do you like to try out songs on the road first and then record them? Or do you do a lot of improvisation in the studio?
It's really great to have some life in these songs before you go in. I didn't have the luxury this time. There are a couple that I had written like very close to recording time. And that's really not ideal because the songs will, as I know a person who says, you know, it's like the lyrics find their way of sitting on the music, you know, mm-hmm. they find their performative thing through performance. So, that's unfortunately some of them I hadn't been able to do that with, but the musicians that you work with, you know, you trust them. And if I did learn when I was recording February, I did this in performance of it that was very personal, and I felt it like super Stanislavski method acting. Yes. Like I'm going to feel this 100%. And the producer was in another room, and he came in. He's like, "That wasn't it." I was like, "Whoa!" Like I was so there. And then I did. I said, "Okay, I guess I'll feel it more." And so I felt it more. And you know, I did all of those acting exercises to like mm-hmm. really be in that moment. And he's like, "Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know." And I was like, you know what? I'll just do it as if I'm like in my voice lessons, and I'll just really pay attention to my vocal technique and really get the notes on, you know, and just get. And he came in and he was crying, and he's like, what happened? Oh my God. And what I realized is that sometimes when you're internal. And so if you're paying attention to what's coming out of your mouth, you're more external. Yeah. And so it's interesting, like, no, method acting is not necessarily the ticket for performing. So I try to just say, look, this is today. I ate this for breakfast. I had this for, you know, I had coffee. I love these guys that I'm performing with. I love this place. I'm going to look up at those lights and, you know, sing in this way. And then we'll see if that's the take. And while they're futzing, I'm going to work on a crossword puzzle so I don't get anxious.
Oh, that's a good tip. Those like dead in between take times can be real, mental, whirlpools. Yeah. I'm not a fan.
Exactly. Yeah. It gets very whirlpool-y. You're right. And so, yeah, word games are really great. Crossword puzzles are great because you can pick them up and put them down.
Fantastic. Okay. I have one final segment, which is the lightning round. We are going for speed here. I like to say it will be timed, but I never bother to time it. So just go from the gut. Okay. No follow-up questions, just whatever comes first to mind. Okay. What is your favorite color?
Purple.
What is the best age to be?
9.
Who is a songwriter who's impressed you lately?
Oh, Chris Matthews and Heather Maloney. Oh, gosh, a lot.
I love Heather Maloney so much. virtual reality or reality TV?
Virtual reality.
Most underrated American town?
Pittsburgh.
Chocolate-covered raisins or yogurt-dipped pretzels?
Raisins.
And finally, you walk into a guitar store and you see the perfect acoustic guitar. You pick it up to try out a song. What song are you playing?
Oh, City of New Orleans by Steve Goodman.
Dar Williams, thank you so much for talking with me. On a personal note, I got a used copy of The Green World at my hometown record store, and it like just was hugely influential. So it's so cool to talk to you about your new music. Everyone go out and get the new album. It is beautiful.
Thank you so much. And good luck. I'm sure we will meet on the road as well.
I'm sure we will. Have a good one. Thanks, Dar.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check out FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can check out our website, BasicFolk.com, or you can find us wherever you listen to your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, perhaps send it to a friend. Maybe that friend that went to all of the Lilith fairs. You know that friend. Send this one to them. They will surely enjoy it. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Talk to you next time. Bye.